Love. Some would say it took a backseat when the pandemic forced us apart. As a family-run and proudly Canadian-owned company, Charm Diamond Centers saw the need to bring us together with tales of love and created the Canadian Love Map podcast. Since then, we've shared hundreds of real, uplifting stories that prove love conquers all. So thank you for listening. We couldn't do it without you. And remember, love starts here. What the world needs now is love. More love.
Stars literally aligned.
He's always been the one.
There's someone out there for everyone.
I'm Nancy Regan, your host on the Canadian Love Map. We are on a journey to uncover and share love stories of all kinds.
He's never forgotten to bring me flowers.
We're hoping we're going to give a little good news to this world.
Even in these dark times, the life continues to go on.
It's all about compassion, devotion, adventure, and of course, love.
Everybody needs somebody. Everybody needs love.
This is the Canadian Love Map.
Well, love is the most important thing.
There's an acute moment I remember when I was on the line in the Olympic Games, and just the thing that crossed my mind when I was ready to start the finals at the Olympics was that when we were training, I would run around Lake Binuk. We would always do it for training. And there was one corner of the lake, and people would often cut that corner. You'd see the grass trampled down on that corner. And every time I got to that corner, I would say to myself, no, you're not going to cut that corner. You're going to go right to the end. And when I was on the line at the games, that's what came to mind, is like, everyone else has cut corners and I haven't. I've never cut the corner. And it was this real confidence, but it's built on something little that was so achievable all the way along.
This week's love story belongs to Julia Rivard Dexter, an innovative tech entrepreneur and former Olympian. After a negative school experience as a child drove her to excel in sport, she began to find her confidence, and it took her all the way to the Olympics. Transitioning into a career as an entrepreneur, her love for her own children led her to create transformative educational tools, games that could help kids learn. Determined to use her ingenuity to prevent history repeating itself, she not only changes the path of her children, but also millions of children around the world. This is the Canadian Love Map. Julia Rivard, welcome to the Canadian Love Map.
Thank you so much. Thrilled to be here.
You know, one of the things I love about hosting this podcast is that I am a terribly curious human being. And I ask a lot of questions anyway. And I get to, in this case, legitimately say, okay, let's go back and tell me about your story from the beginning. And then I get to just lean in and listen. So take it away, Julia.
Okay. So my story from the beginning, and it's funny because I've had a chance to reflect on this over the last couple of years. And I think it took kind of really proactive reflection to understand why I've come to where I am today. Probably haven't learned it all yet, but I look back at my childhood and such a great childhood in North Bay, Ontario, amazing parents, younger brother, really had all the love in the world and really struggled as a student at school, but had two parents that just believed in me being just this superhero in their lives. And their belief in me gave me a confidence to believe that I could do something great, even though I was really, really struggling at school. And so in grade four, I was in a class that was the 3-4 split, and the teachers and the kids, everyone dubbed it the dumb class because the grade fours were in with the grade threes.
Oh, I remember that expression. And that was a thing when I was in school as well. Yeah. There was, in grade seven, for instance, 7.1, 7.2, could see as you went down, it was kids who were not engaged.
Absolutely.
And not doing well.
It's amazing when you reflect on that. Kind of the position that put kids in at such an early age when they're still really developing. I was the only girl in the class, in the dumb class. All my friends had been put into the 4-5 split. And it just left me with this feeling that I just wasn't good enough in this arena. But I had this confidence that had been built, through a loving upbringing. And so my father at the time, he told me, Julia, I want you to do 21 sports before you're 21. And so I took that seriously as a goal that I wanted to pursue. And I just started knocking them off. And swimming became my favorite. Swimming was my sport, the one that I wanted to do well in. And I put everything into that. And in return, I had coaches who saw my potential and really invested in me, which put me on a path to go on to be really successful in sport. So that's where the story begins. And I think without that, I definitely wouldn't be where I am today. But, you know, years later, I have four kids now, but my second son, Max, was really struggling with reading. And I saw him going through the same thing that I was going through. And I didn't, my love for Max as a mother, you know, that love is just, there's like nothing else, right? You're going to walk across water to do whatever you can for your kids. And I just wanted to help him see his potential too. I had built several businesses already in technology, and I thought maybe there's a way I can use my background in technology to be able to support Max and other kids like him. Because very quickly after seeing that Max was struggling, I was looking into the problem and saw, you know, half of our kids were struggling with learning how to read. So I knew we could do better. So that was kind of the beginning of the story.
Well, that's amazing. I love what you say about the way in which your parents reacted to your struggle,
right,
and the way you reacted to Max's struggle, because sometimes it can trigger us as parents, and I speak from personal experience. I remember when my daughter was having trouble with math in grade two, and I was finding myself getting frustrated, right, because it was totally bringing me back to my own issues.
Right.
And I had to step away from it and go, okay, who is this about here? And we have some learning challenges in my family. And so I'm fascinated to know how you went from there and what you created for Max that ended up being, you know, so essential and so amazingly helpful to so many other kids.
Yeah.
But first, I want to know, what was it you loved about swimming?
Oh, about swimming. What did I love? I was good at it. Mm-hmm. I loved the fact that I could see success and that I felt like it actually, I felt like I could be the best. And I really wanted to be an Olympic athlete from the time I was little, which was silly because I came from Northern Ontario. There was no real pathway to get there. But I loved the fact that I felt like I had potential. And then as people saw that potential, it gave me more fuel and more fire to do it. So, yeah, I think that's what it was. I think also the individual nature of the sport for me was right. I've always been somebody who's really hard on myself. And I think in a team dynamic, sometimes I worry about letting the group down. And so the individual nature allowed me to focus on being the best I could be, which was helpful.
And in the telling of your story, you kind of smoothed right over the whole Olympic thing.
Yeah.
So let's talk sure. about that. I think, I don't know, I find that quite impressive. And I'd love to let the listeners know more about that journey. How did that evolve from finding swimming to realizing that you were really good, seeing good success, and then hello, Olympics.
Yeah, and I wish it was that easy. So I was quite a good swimmer, you know, top 10 in Canada when I was 11, 12. By the time I was in high school, I was doing really well and kind of on the track to be at the national level. But I was in a ski accident and I broke my back, actually, and that put me out for several months. And when I recovered from that injury, everyone had kind of passed me in swimming. You know, I'd really lost ground. At that level, it's really easy to quickly lose ground. And it's kind of hard psychologically to get back. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of lost interest in swimming at that point. And at the same time, the canoe club in North Bay, which had been dormant for several years, was picking back up. And I was recruited to come paddle, and I thought, you know, maybe this is something new that I can try that's exciting. And a few friends of mine started. And so we had this great group, and I just started paddling. And that summer of 1995, I guess it was, I went to the national championships in Welland, Ontario, and I competed in the senior women's against, it was Karen Furneaux, actually, a local Nova cool. Scotian who's been an outstanding athlete over the years. And I was able to beat Karen in that race, which I don't know how it happened because it must have, I must have just had a race in my life that day. But it gave me, again, that confidence, like, hey, maybe I can do something great here. And so I started training for canoe kayak at that point. And, you know, 4 years later, I was at the Olympics. The base I had in swimming definitely got me there, but I...
Because of strength or work ethic or what
all,
do you mean?
All the above. All the above. Yeah. You know, there's a really nice transfer in terms of the muscles you need for swimming and what you need for canoe kayak. It's a great transition sport, but also work ethic for sure. You know, over the years, I'd really built a discipline, another individual sport in this case. Now, I competed in the K4 at the Olympics, but to get there, you had to be at the top in the individual kayak. So, yeah, so I spent, you know, it wasn't a long time. It doesn't seem like a long time getting there, 4 years, but it was really kind of the, you know, the decade before that of the training I was doing in swimming that really helped me get there quickly. And yeah.
You know, a lot of people have played sports as kids, and mm-hmm. I played a lot of basketball. And in fact, my basketball team in Ottawa won the Ontario Championships, which was such an exciting memory to have now. Yeah. But I can't even conceive of how much discipline it takes to become an Olympic athlete. Mm. So tell me about that. What does it really require to get to that level and to do well?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think the answer might be different for different Olympians that you talk to. But I think if I were to isolate what really helped me get there was this ability to really live in the moment. All the time, you know, doing the best I can absolutely do in that moment, not thinking too far ahead in terms of what could happen or what might not happen. Definitely not thinking back. I'm the worst at thinking back. My mom says I have no memory of anything. So not wasting energy on retrospective thinking or thinking too far ahead and just really focusing on the moment and how you can take the best next step forward. I really think for me, that was it. And because that's all you can ever do in life, right?
Well, I was going to say that is a lesson for life.
Right.
Not just the Olympics.
Right. And so for any of us to reach our full potential, it's really important to realize that all you can affect is the change in the moment that you're in at that specific moment. And I think that by doing that, you really do have an opportunity to go as far as you possibly can, because your environment and everything around you, it's going to happen, right? You can't control all of that, but you can control you. And I used to have the kind of a saying when I was paddling, keep your blinders on, right? You can't really look at anything else because it's only you that you can affect change with. So I'd say I'd isolate it to that. Yeah.
So how do you describe your experience at the Olympics?
It's blurry.
I was going to say, your mom says you don't remember anything. Do you remember it?
Not much. I remember after the Olympics, shipping my passport back in the shipping container with all my stuff and getting stuck in Australia for 2 weeks, which is a bit of a blessing. But it is very blurry. It's so true what they say about the journey being more important than the destination, because there's an acute moment I remember, and I've shared this before, when I was on the line in the Olympic Games. And just the thing that crossed my mind when I was ready to start the finals at the Olympics was that when we were training, I would run around Lake Binuk. We would always do it for training. You'll see kids today still running every day for their fitness. And there was one corner of the lake between Creighton and Hawthorne. I can remember it right now. And people would often cut that corner. You'd see the grass trampled down on that corner. And every time I got to that corner, I would say to myself, no, you're not going to cut that corner. You're going to go right to the end. And when I was on the line at the games, that's what came to mind, is like everyone else has cut corners and I haven't. I've never cut the corner. And it's this false sense of confidence that you can build in yourself. It's a real confidence, but it's built on kind of something little that was so achievable all the way along. So yeah, it's funny because that's probably my most acute memory from the games, was that feeling. And again, transferable to life, right? Like, mm-hmm. just don't cut corners. It's a pretty easy thing to follow. So
that becomes a superpower. If everyone else is cutting corners and you don't,
right,
that's your extra oomph.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. And we can all do it. Yeah. We can all do it.
So how did your experience at the Olympics and, you know, your whole journey through sport really get you ready, do you think, for your career? Because you've had such an interesting and innovative career.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's mentally challenging training at that level for years. And I think running a business and starting businesses and you know, the ups and downs of business, it's mentally challenging. And just believing in the fact that you're doing your best every step of the way and that something will come of it. And just this belief that you can do it is so important, because there's so many times building a business where you get discouraged, or, you know, you get kind of run down, and you have to keep believing that there will be an outcome that will be worth it, even though you can't necessarily see that in the moment. So I think that really, really helped. I think the other thing is just understanding how important it is to build teams around you who are focused on the same vision you have, right? So I had coaches, we had mental trainers, we had teammates, and we were all focused on achieving this big vision, which was, achieving at the Olympic Games. And in business, it's never just about you. It's always about the team of people who have a very, very specific shared vision that's aligned. And the Olympics was easy because it's so specific, and you can identify what you need to do to get there. In business, it's always a little bit more difficult, especially innovative businesses that I've been a part of, because you can't see the finish line always. And so
the goal's always moving.
It's always moving. And sometimes it's behind a bit of a cloud, and you can't see, you know, exactly how you're going to get there. So you just have to trust. You really have to have faith that these steps that you're taking are going to get you there or somewhere, yeah. You know, even if it's not where you think you're going, you're going to go somewhere. And ultimately, just you have to have a faith that it's going to be something you're proud of doing. Yep.
So when you came home from the Olympics, conquering hero, you've done this. Did you get right into business? Was it an easy transition?
No, I didn't. I did decide right away I was going to be done with sport. I was sure that I wanted to move on to something else. I was keen to kind of build a foundation in something new, you know, because I think if you keep going in something like racing at an Olympic level, the difference you're going to make is incremental. And I wanted to have big gains again. I wanted to see big progress. And so I went.
Which says a lot. Sorry to interrupt, but that says a lot about you as a person as well, because I think a lot of people's tendency would be to want to cling to that glory.
Sure.
You know, if you define yourself by that and you let that nestle into your ego, there is a great temptation to keep doing it because that defines you. But it's the sign of someone really confident who says, okay, I did that. Now what can I do?
Yeah, confident, or, you know, maybe maybe I was looking for an easy way to see success again, because it's hard to see incremental gain. Like, I can see ego wanting to hold on to that, but it's also a risk to want to try to improve just a little bit. Whereas if you start all over, you only have up to go, right?
Yeah,
and I think my mind was maybe more there. Let me start with something that I'm passionate about, but that I'm really not very good at, because I know I can improve. I know I can put these skills towards something else. So went back to school to NASCAD, which I absolutely love, the Nova Scotia College of Art and Design. And I started in painting, and I wasn't a very good painter. So I got into...
That's subjective.
It is. Yeah. I believed I wasn't a very good painter. And so I got into graphic design and graduated from school. And at the time, while I was at school, I'd had my first son, Oscar. And then when I graduated, immediately had my second son, Max. And I needed to get a job. And that was extremely hard. I really applied to every creative agency I could, and no one would hire me. I just wasn't seen as having enough kind of work experience, you know, the specific skills. And so that was a really rough time for me, just trying to, I knew I wanted to do something great again. I just couldn't figure out how to get my foot in the door.
And also, I'm sure, hard as a successful person to be experiencing that lack of success in convincing someone to hire you. Like, hello, I'm an Olympian.
It's the same feeling I had in grade 4 with my teachers who didn't see my potential because I wasn't doing well at school. It was like, please see me. Just like, give me a chance, you know? Like, I feel like we all have those moments where it's like, I really have something special. Just give me a chance. And it takes people that will give you a chance to to be able to get there. And that's what happened for me. I was at one of those kind of sports celebrity dinner things, and I met a man. His name's Dr. Ken Rockwood, and we got chatting, and he asked me what I was doing, and I said, well, I'm running my own business, which wasn't true. Like, I just had to make something up. And he actually hired me that night to do work for him, and he was my first client. And so when I think about my journey in business and entrepreneurship, it was not planned. It was kind of out of necessity, something I fell into. And I really credit people along the way like Ken, who just gave me a shot.
We couldn't share the great stories that we do here on the Canadian Love Map podcast without the amazing support of Charm Diamond Centres. They are Canada's largest family-owned jeweler, and they're proud to be putting love on the map. The folks at Charm Diamond Centres are thrilled to be a part of your love story. So visit charmdiamondcentres.com or one of your local stores. Love starts here. Well, and it's interesting, for context for listeners from across the country and beyond, I want to say that Ken was not just some guy at that event. Dr. Ken Rockwood is a geriatrician mm-hmm. with a worldwide reputation. He is a brilliant, brilliant physician and human. He's really amazing. And obviously, he saw something in you.
He's first class, and he's done amazing things, focused on excellence, and he's been respected for it. But he's also somebody who will put his hand out and pull somebody up. Mm-hmm. He's always looking to find ways to help pull people up. And he did that for me that night. And we worked together for years and stayed in touch for years after that. And I just have so much time for Ken and what he did for me, because he had no clue what he was doing for me that night. And it really made a huge difference. But anyway, that was a kickoff to my business career. And it started as a graphic designer.
Okay. And so where did it grow from there?
So graphic design was a really kind of evolving field when I first got into it. I was in the print media, and that was evolving to digital media. And I could see that. I could see myself becoming irrelevant pretty quickly. And so I bought a building with the money that I made from my business and converted that building into a studio where people like me could work together. Multidisciplinary artists, creative people could work together. And I started working with people who were engineers, software engineers, web designers, and we formed really a collective of people who could work on larger projects, and it was outstanding. It was called Queen Street Studios, and one of the people I met there was an engineer, and he and I came together and built a business that was focused on web development and software design. So I was able to evolve from being just a kind of a print focused graphic designer into more of a creative director at a software company. And that's what got me into technology. And I got really excited about this idea that you could take concepts and digitize them in a way that was super interactive and really, it felt like something that was very new at the time, building websites, building software. So,
but were you figuring it out as you went?
Yeah.
Because you didn't go to school specifically for this field.
No.
Wow.
No, I've always kind of just figured things out as I go, for good or for bad. No, I didn't understand at all kind of what the engineering piece meant. But you sit in rooms long enough with engineers and you listen and you start to understand and
surround yourself with good people.
Totally. Back to the point of having great teams. I had outstanding software developers around me who would take the time and we would share kind of our insights on different things. And over time, I got to be quite proficient in understanding engineering and software design and development. But I've never been an engineer myself. I've never been a developer. But that got me into building companies focused on technology. Yeah. So that was my first company. And then I had two more companies after that. And it wasn't until 2014 that I started to focus on what I'm doing now at Shoelace.
And is that looping us back to Max?
That loops us back to Max. Yeah.
So there's the love connection.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, in 2014, I just sold a business. I had some time on my hands and I wanted to support Max because his teacher had come to me and told me he was a very low reader and not super confident about his chances. She kind of didn't see his potential either. And I knew he was capable. So I wanted to understand what's going on. He was sent to a psychologist for diagnosis. At the time, that took 12 months to get a grade four student in. Wow. And for me, or you could pay $1,000 to get them in for a private assessment. And that really bothered me because we paid for the assessment, but I knew there's so many families that couldn't. And if you leave a kid at grade four for a year in a position where they can't read, you are just killing their confidence and their ability to succeed. It wasn't right. Like, we had to do better by our kids. But I didn't understand the problem. And what I had learned over the years was you can't find a solution without really finding out what the problem is first. So Sandra McKenzie, who was the Deputy Minister of Education at the time here in Nova Scotia, and another champion, you know, this is a theme in the story. There have been people all along the way who've put their hand out and pulled me up. And I visited Sandra in her office and I said, I want to tackle this problem. I have a background in technology, not sure what the outcome's going to be yet, but would you let me shadow teachers in the classroom? And she said, absolutely. And she put me in schools down in Tri-County. So I drove down every single day.
Oh, that's so cool.
It was so cool. And I was able to shadow teachers to really see what was happening in the classroom. And had I not done that, I would not be where I am today.
You would have been making assumptions about what was needed.
And you know, the coolest piece was within the first few weeks, I was thinking, okay, we're going to build something that's going to help kids want to learn how to read, right? Like, it was all about literacy. But in the first couple of weeks, I was in grade one and two classrooms, and I was seeing teachers use technology with kids where kids would have to log into their accounts. You try to get a grade one logging in with a complex login system, it takes the whole class to get all 25, 30 of your students log in. It was a disaster.
That sounds like
and
a nightmare.
Kids are bouncing off the walls. And I'm thinking, no teacher is going to want to use technology when this is the how they're doing it. So what we did first was we just built a login system that was picture-based that the kids really loved. There was no product on the other side. It was literally just a login system. Kids loved it. Teachers loved it. And there was no product. It was just the login. And so that's just such a good example of
So that was just a little exercise.
Yeah. But, you know, we had to get that done first before we could do anything that, you know, effective with technology. But it's just such a great example of just getting in the space, understanding the problem deeply, and then trying to build to that specific problem. The other thing that we saw was behavior management. Classrooms really are struggling today with behavior management. We have inclusive classrooms, which is great, but it also means that we have some kids that are really struggling to work in environments where there are 25 other kids. And right now, teachers don't have the supports they need to be able to manage classrooms with kids who have behavior needs that are outside of the norm. And we were seeing that with classrooms where you have one or two kids that just throw the whole classroom off for the whole period and no learning happens. So what we decided at that time was if we're going to build something, one, they have to be able to log into it. Simple. And then two, it has to keep them engaged. We can't provide teachers with anything that isn't going to get kids to check in and to stay checked in.
So you're helping teachers rather than giving them another layer of challenge and difficulty in their classroom.
Absolutely. Because our kids, they have access to such amazing interactive media these days outside the classroom. So to think that we're going to put them in a classroom and make them sit for hours and focus on tools that are, you know, paper-based manipulatives that are frankly just really boring, they're not going to do it. They just won't want to do it. And so we knew we could do better. And that's what got us focused on game-based learning. And so we started building our tools to deliver reading instruction through games that kids would absolutely love. And that was launched in 2014. And our first product was called Squiggle Park. So that was where we started.
Tell me a little about Squiggle Park, if you would.
So Squiggle Park was an early reading tool. It was for preschool to grade two, all the basic reading skills. Over the last couple of years, this idea of science of reading has come back into favor in curriculum. It's this idea of rigor around letter sounds, letter names, phonemes, phonemic awareness, so that kids can actually decode words properly. So for a while, we went into a reading approach that was just give kids lots of books and they'll read, which is great for kids who can pick up reading easily, not good for those who struggle. They really need the rigor of developing these skills. And that's what Squiggle Park did. It was a highly successful tool and we had it in the market from 2016 to 2020. But I retired that product because I was so frustrated with selling into the education system. It was beyond frustrating. We had these teachers who were doing their best with students who absolutely loved the product but couldn't get the budgets to buy it. And so I'd end up just giving them licenses. And frankly, it's not a good business.
Not a good business model.
No. So anyway, I retired that product and we developed a whole new platform called Shoelace Learning, which is the product we have today. And we decided we're going to have a free product available to teachers that would be able to be upgraded, very much like the software we buy in our regular lives, you know, freemium, and you can upgrade it if you want the premium features. And that proved to be hugely successful. We got to about 2 million users in 2 years, and now we've had over 7 million users on the platform. And it's focused on later reading skills, so kids in grades 3 to 8, and it focuses on comprehension. So everything from basic understanding characters and settings up to skills that kids really need today. And when you look at reading scores right now, 70% of kids are below basic in the United States on these higher level comprehension skills. So we've got
70
below basic. It's not even below proficient. And so we're really struggling in this area. And so there's a real window for Shoelace right now to support kids in a way that's super, super engaging. So we help teachers by delivering really effective reading curriculum through games that they love to play. So they play the games and they are introduced to their curriculum as they play. And it's used in the classroom and used at home. So parents really benefit from getting something that kids want to play that's learning-based, which is nice.
So what sort of, you said it caught on really quickly.
Yeah.
What sort of feedback have you gotten, and how has that fed the machine?
Yeah, the feedback that we've had has mainly been from teachers, because that's how we got to the market at first, was just through teachers, and which is, thank you. Thank you for building something that our kids want to play. We have kids who, you know, they want to be playing it in other classes now, and they want to be playing it on recess, which we don't encourage. Like, it really is something that that's supporting teachers in their classrooms, because they're just checked in. And teachers can see too, like they can see through the data that we provide them specifically where kids are struggling, which is giving them the ability to remediate in a way that they never could before. Because what people don't know is that most teachers aren't taught how to teach reading. And where you get into real trouble is in the higher grades, when you have kids in grades 4, 5, 6 who haven't ever mastered those skills when they were younger. Mm-hmm. These teachers really don't know how to teach reading. It's just not what they were trained to do.
It's not in their wheelhouse.
No. And so you'll have teachers teaching cross subjects, and the kids can't consume the subjects because they don't have strong reading comprehension skills. And so our tool is able to be used in those classes to get kids not only up to speed in their reading, but allow them to start consuming the learning across all subjects. So yeah, we've seen a real opportunity for this to really move the needle for kids. It's very, very exciting.
What do your kids think about it?
Well, Max is now 20, and he's a firefighter. So I didn't get to use Shoelace with Max, unfortunately, but I have a 9-year-old now, and she was struggling with reading. And this summer, we spent weeks just playing for 30 minutes a week, and I could actually see her progression happening week over week over week. And it was so exciting for me to have that full circle moment where I built it for Max, but I never got to use it with Max. But to see it helping Madeline, it was incredible for me to feel like what we had built could have such an impact, and to see it firsthand with one of my own kids. Mm-hmm. That's been amazing. I think the other thing, I had a lot of moments of real guilt, you know, when I was building this business at the beginning, because I spent so much time working, traveling, trying to build this company. And not being home with my kids, like, which is something I think we as women just feel, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
You're trying to do your best at work, you're trying to do your best with your kids, and you often feel like you're not doing a good enough job in either place. But, you know, last year, my son Oscar, who's at Acadia University, he called me on FaceTime in class, quietly, and he said, "Mom, guess what?" And I said, "What?" And he turned the FaceTime over towards the wall, and up on the projector screen was Shoelace, and it was a picture of me, and they were doing a case study on our company, not knowing that it was his mom. And he said, "Mom, I'm so proud of you." And it was just like such a full circle moment too for me to be like, you know, he's not bitter, he's like proud. And that it was awesome, because it made me feel like all of those kind of regrets can just be kind of put away. because they see
you realize that you were modeling.
Yeah,
you know, you might not have been putting plates on the table during that time, but you modeled something really important for them, and I'm sure you gave them tons of confidence. So you see that with your own kids, and then when you think on a grander scale, about the difference you're making in the world, how does that sit with you?
That is it's a really important thing to slow down and think about sometimes. Because, you know, in the day-to-day, when you're in the weeds, you're not always thinking about the impact you're having. But it's really important, I think, especially in those hard moments, like when you're really struggling with something specific, to just pick your head up and just take a deep breath and realize there are millions of kids who've been helped with Shoelace. There are hundreds of thousands of teachers and parents who've been helped with Shoelace. And that's why we do it ultimately. You know, I was talking about the journey versus the destination in the Olympics. Yeah, I have to realize that I'm in it, this journey, and we're doing it. And I don't know what the destination is. We never know because it's not in our control, right? It could be, you know, a great exit at some point, or it could be something else. And you just don't know. So it's really important. I feel like I should have the wisdom at this point to realize that this is what it is all about. And I have to slow myself down to realize that sometimes. But
Well, then to not ask in a specific way, but in a more general way, has your ability to impact so many lives sort of made you really focused on purpose moving forward in your business? Is it necessarily that whatever you do next, is it necessarily going to be that intersection of making money and helping people?
Absolutely. Because I don't think, you know, there's been times that are extremely low times in building business. We all have them for every entrepreneur out there. And if there wasn't that purpose piece, if there wasn't that impact piece, there would be very little that would keep me going, you know. And being able to affect change, to have real impact in a way that is changing people's lives it's so motivating. It's more motivating than any kind of financial outcome for me personally. Yeah, to me, it makes me work harder. It makes me do better. And I need to have purpose in what I'm doing to work as hard as I do to keep pushing further.
So that's my definition of love in action. And I want to wrap up by asking you, what is love to you? What's your definition of love?
Oh, that's a great question. I think love for me is... it's so deep. It's something that absolutely drives you. It drives you because you care so deeply, right? Love to me makes me be a better person because I want to show up for those I love and those who I can make a difference for. Yeah, I've been very lucky to have very loving relationships in my life, and they've made me into a much better person because I want to show up for those people. And you know, in business, I want to show up for the people who we're helping, and that makes me a better person. So I guess you're right. I guess this is a definition of love in business that I hadn't really thought about. But I feel very lucky in love.
Mic drop. Thank you so much for joining me today. I really loved our conversation.
Thank you. Me too.
Thanks so much for listening to the Canadian Love Map. This podcast is presented and made possible by Charm Diamond Centers. It's hosted by me, Nancy Regan, and is produced and distributed by Podstarter. We love sharing love stories of all kinds, and that could include yours. So do you or someone you know have an uplifting tale to tell? Reach out to us on Facebook or Instagram using @CanadianLoveMap or email producer@podstarter.io. We'll be back next week with another love story to add to the map.